From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross.
Five guys, 12 pubs, 50 pints.
60 pints.
I haven't had a drink for 16 years, Gary.
You must be thirsty then.
The World's End is a new comedy about five friends who reunite for a pub crawl they began 20 years earlier. Today we talk with stars Simon Pegg and Nick Frost. It's their third film with director Edgar Wright after Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz. They've been friends for years, and it was Pegg who got Frost to start acting.
You initially weren't a huge fan of it, were you?
No. Well, you know, I'd never done it before, you know, I'd never acted before. It was like My Fair Lady, but with a big fat man. My fat lady.
Also, Ken Tucker reviews Robin Thicke's album Blurred Lines, and John Powers introduces us to the character Jack Irish, a hard-boiled detective who's distinctly Australian. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross, who's off this week. If you've seen the movie Shaun of the Dead, I probably don't have to tell you much about Simon Pegg and Nick Frost. That 2004 zombie send-up gave the English comedy pair a cult following that grew with their follow-up movie Hot Fuzz, about a gung-ho London cop who's transferred to a sleepy English village. Both those films were directed by their friend Edgar Wright, who also made the visually innovative film Scott Pilgrim vs. the World. Now Pegg Frost and Edgar Wright have reunited for a third time in the new movie The World's End. All three films were co-written by Wright and Simon Pegg. Pegg and Frost have continued to build their own careers in between their collaborations with Wright. Pegg appeared in two Mission Impossible films and two recent Star Trek movies, and Frost had roles in the films Attack the Block and Snow White and the Huntsman. They also co-wrote and starred in the sci-fi comedy Paul, which featured Seth Rogen as a pot-smoking alien. Their new film, The World's End, is about five old high school friends who reunite to finish a pub crawl they started 20 years before. When they get to their old town, very strange things happen. Here's a scene early in the film when Simon Pegg's character Gary, a heavy-drinking perpetual adolescent, is trying to persuade Nick Frost's character Andy, now a respectable teetotaling lawyer, to join his old mates for another go at the pubs of their youth.
We had ourselves a little idea.
Did you know?
Yeah, we're going to go back to Newton Haven.
Why?
For some unfinished business.
That's a joke, right?
Five guys, 12 pubs, 50 pints.
60 pints.
Steady on you, Alky.
I haven't had a drink for 16 years, Gary.
You must be thirsty then. But we can go back, see the guys, chew the fat, it'll be just like it always was. Except this time, we are going to finish this thing once and for all.
You have a very selective memory, Gary.
Thanks.
You remember the Friday nights. I remember the Monday mornings.
Yeah, that's why we're going back on a Friday.
Why do you think none of us live in Newton Haven anymore? Because it is a black hole. It's boring. It always was and it always will be.
It's only boring because we're not there.
It's pointless arguing with you.
Exactly. So come.
And that is Nick Frost and Simon Pegg from their new film, The World's End. Gentlemen, welcome to Fresh Air.
Nice
Thank
to be
you
here
for having us, David.
Simon Pegg, let's talk about your character here. I mean, you know, you've played a lot of roles where you're really likable. Here, you're, well, maybe, why don't you describe this guy, Gary? He's a little intimidating.
Yeah, he's a kind of obnoxious and not entirely sympathetic. He's, you know, he's this guy who had the greatest night of his life in June 1990 and has never, ever matched it. Which, when you think about it, is rather tragic. He sort of says it in a sort of celebratory way at the beginning, like, never got better than that. When in actual fact, that is the mark of someone who has no happiness in his present. And that's why he's so desperate to get back there and recreate the night with his friends, because in a way, he's trying to recreate the circumstances in which he was last truly happy.
Nick, do you identify with at all with a guy wanting to go back and relive his high school days?
I'd say no. I'm not a very, you know, I tend to just try and look forward. I'm not a very nostalgic man, really. I mean, I think if I ever need to, you know, look back, I do it with music, essentially, or food. I've got an amazing recipe for a beef stroganoff that my mum taught me to cook when I was 10. And so when I cook that and eat it, it's kind of, for me, the ultimate time machine. I think that while listening to Hatful of Hollow by the Smiths, and that's kind of all the nostalgia a man needs.
You know, the director Edgar Wright says that this film and the other ones that you've done together, that a lot of the fun of them is taking people's perceived stereotypes of the United Kingdom and turning them on their heads. How does that work in this film, in The World's End?
We've always been very keen to not set our films in picture postcard England. You know, there is usually in a movie when you cut to the UK, you'll hear a little bit of Rule Britannia, and you'll see a red bus go by, and Big Ben will strike. It'll be snowing, and someone will step off the Millennium Wheel, of the London Eye. It was important to us to set our films in the real England, in the real places where we grew up, the suburbs of London, not London itself, and the little village that, you know, Edgar grew up in, and these garden cities that we created Newton Haven from. But we also adopt certain stereotypical aspects of British life because, you know, stereotypes, there's a reason they are stereotypes. And the big one has been the pub as a centre for, you know, as a sort of social nexus, which it very much is in the UK. The pub is an important place in many ways, not just to drink. It's a, you know, the word pub is short for public house, and that's what the feel of these places is. It's a sort of communal space. I get the feeling here in the US, you know, bars are places I imagine people sitting up at the bar talking to the barman, drinking, usually alone. They're places where you go to imbibe alcohol.
It's a place a gumshoe might go to drink two fingers of whiskey.
Exactly. whereas the pub is a different dynamic, and you know, after we did Hot Fuzz and we'd shot a few scenes in pubs, Edgar actually said to our producer Nara, "I never want to shoot in a pub again." And his next film featured 12
pubs. Yes,
what a hypocrite. So yeah, that's kind of our thing. We don't want to be transatlantic with our movies in terms of we don't assume the American audience have to be talked down to in any way or soft soaped or given some kind of chocolate box version of what they're seeing, because I think Shaun of the Dead proved to us that we could be resolutely British and it would still work over here. In fact, it would work because of that. You know, a lot of films who want to get an American distribution deal will put stuff in specifically to try and secure that, and that ends up just feeling fake. And
it dilutes, I think, the thing that people liked about us in the first place, you know.
Yeah, so we're kind of, we don't trade on our ethnicity, but we don't, we also don't sort of lie about it.
We didn't hide it, you know. We are British. We're British filmmakers.
One of the fun things is that when these guys go back 20 years later to the pubs that they remembered, these distinctive pubs of their childhood, they've changed. Do you want to describe kind of what's happened to the pubs of their school days?
Yeah, well, one of the ideas about that came through in the writing of the film was this idea, and it's an idea that we've always sort of been interested in, this the notion of homogenization of losing identity to something else. That happens in Shaun of the Dead, it happens in Hot Fuzz, and it happens on a grand scale in this. And often when you return to your hometown, the place where you grew up, it'll feel very similar but very different. And one of those differences is usually that the high street has changed. And of late, you know, the high streets have all become like small Londons. You know, the big chains have moved in, your McDonald's and your Starbucks, and this is happening in to the pubs as well. They're being bought up by chains and sort of recreated as little folksy meeting places, when in actual fact they're sort of, you know, brand specific homogenized corporate entities that don't really have any character.
Right, they seem sterile and identical, really. I mean, it's
yeah, they're just also, you know, I mean, alcohol in pubs is so heavily taxed by the Chancellor that it essentially gentrifies a pub, and I think something which, you know, in a system of class like we have in Britain, I always think that a pub is a classless place. You know, you can get a labourer or a bricklayer standing next to a lord and having a pint. You know, I think that's the great thing about British pubs. And now, because it is so expensive to drink in a pub, people aren't drinking in pubs.
Now it's just lords.
Now it's just the lords, which is very boring. The pubs stink of wax jackets and pink corduroys. You know, I think it drives the working man away from a place where we met to meet friends and you know, family.
Do the two of you, I mean, since you've done so much work together, when you're doing sequences in a film like, you know, The World's End, does it just feel like play acting sometimes with a buddy? I mean, do you find cracking each other up with inside jokes?
Well, we write a very tight script, Edgar and myself, in this sort of creative arrangement. Edgar and I write a very, very tight script. We give it, Nick is the first person to read it so that he can start to bring his own touches to it. Then we rehearse with the cast. Any kind of improvisation that might occur during rehearsal is fed into the script if it works, so that when we hit the deck, we hit it running. You know, we have a specific goal at the end of each day. But I think having a friendship, having a sort of ease of communication and a similar sensibilities really does aid the creative process. It enables us to have a shorthand, which is very effective. And on set, we are, you know, totally in tune with each other and with Edgar.
I mean, I'd also say to that, and, you know, that said, I'm a big fan of what Simon does. So, you know, I enjoy sitting on set acting in a scene with Simon, and because there are, I mean, I'm kind of convinced there are two parts of your brain when you're acting. One part, which is kind of flicking through the dialogue Rolodex and concentrating on what to say next, and then you have another part which is like a free floating vapor that can look around and say, "God, this is really good. You know, I'm really enjoying this." And so, you know,
look at Martin Freeman, he's acting.
Look at Martin Freeman acting. Look at Eddie Marzan, Emrah. You know, I think it's very selfless of Simon and Edgar to, certainly in Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz, for Simon to kind of be the straight man, because that's not necessarily how it is in our relationship personally. You know, we are both each other's straight men, and we are both the crazy funny ones at times.
We're speaking with Nick Frost and Simon Pegg. They star in the new film, The World's End. And we'll continue our conversation after a quick break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and our guests are actors Simon Pegg and Nick Frost. They appeared together in Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz, and Paul. Their new film, directed by Edgar Wright, is The World's End. I want to talk a little bit about your long collaboration, but first, before you guys met. Now, Simon, you had a background in theater, right? You studied drama. You want to just tell us a little bit of how you got into the business?
I did. When I was about 15, I think, It never occurred to me that I might be able to follow acting as a career. I lived in a part of the country that was very far from London, seemed far from everything. It was sort of the Tatooine of the United Kingdom, I call it. And it suddenly became apparent that there was a college in Stratford-upon-Avon, the home of the great William Shakespeare, that ran a course where theatre studies was like a major. And I got a grant from a local authority, a trust in my village called the Lady Down Trust. By strange coincidence, an elderly wealthy woman had died and left a lot of money to fund potentially artistic children from the village I was from, which was, you know, I'll never not be grateful for, because it meant that I could go to this college. And I studied theatre at A-level, and then I went on to study at university. I didn't go to drama school because I didn't necessarily want to be... Drama schools will sometimes shape their graduates to what they think an actor should be, and I didn't necessarily want to endure that. So in my university education, I became interested in stand-up comedy, or I had been since I was a kid. I became re-interested in it, and really launched myself when I graduated into the real world as a stand-up.
Nick, tell us, you know, you're parents ran a furniture business when you were young, right? And there were some hard times, I guess, when you were kind of a teenager.
Yeah. Well, my dad, he started his own office chair design company, and he was kind of designing high-end office chairs. And he kind of went off on his own to do his own business, and sadly, it became slightly too successful for him on his own to make all the chairs that he had ordered. And sadly, we kind of lost our business, which meant that we lost our home and everything we had. So as a 15-year-old boy, I kind of found myself and my mum and dad and our giant Alsatian Sheba living in one room, essentially, which was... It was shattering, really, to be honest. And it you know, my father had you know, I don't know how to put this. He became very ill. My mother became very ill, and that was kind of that, really. I left school at 15 to try and be the man and to try and bring some money into our family. Which sounds very tragic. I mean, don't get me wrong, we still had a laugh as a family, you know. It didn't dampen that side of us.
And then you went off to Israel.
Right.
I kind of got to a point in my life where I was kind of sick of it, really. of living in London and you know, living in this awful council estate. So I essentially ran away to the Middle East for 2 years.
Was your family Jewish, or was this just an experience you
wanted to have? No, I just had a friend of mine called Brendan Hegarty, who had been on a kibbutz, and he said, I think it would be really good for you to run off and become a fish farmer or an apple picker for a while. So that was it. I think I intended to go for 3 months at first, and then there was something about the society and living on the land and it being a very regimented kind of life that I loved. I think I would have been pretty good in the army or in prison.
Still am.
It could still am. So, yeah, I ended up staying for, I think I stayed for 19 months on my first visit. Then I came home and realised that I don't think I was ready to come home. So I went back again for another 6 months or something.
It's like the Hurt Locker.
It's just like the Hurt Locker. I'm like Jeremy Renner.
And is it
That's
true
the that... only way in which I'm like with Jeremy Renner.
And is it true that you wrote a novel called The Alcoholic's Guide to the Holy Land?
It is true, yeah. I mean, it's terrible. It's so bad. I still have a copy.
It's one more novel than I've written.
But I never wanted to act. I never wanted to be an actor, but I was always... you know, I'm a romantic, and I always had some weird romantic ideal of being some terribly poor Soviet novelist living in like a windy garret drinking, you know, a watery potato soup. That was kind of romantic to me and writing. And I kind of fell in love with a girl called Cheryl, and I was like 25 and she was 19, and I really fell head over heels. And so I essentially wrote this novel to show off to her, because I think she liked the fact that I wanted to be a writer. So I kind of did it to impress a girl. But I didn't have a table. I just had an ironing board and a typewriter. So every morning I'd sit at this ironing board and smash out a few pages. But I have one. I have one of the manuscripts, and she has one too. But I haven't seen her since I was 25. So.
Oh, I bought it for my Kindle the other day.
I want to get to when you first met. Nick, you were working in a restaurant, right? And just who wants to tell the story?
Yeah, well, we'll both chime in. But I was working at a Mexican restaurant called Chiquito's in a place called Cricklewood in North London.
Look for it; it's still there.
It's still there. Yeah, and I, you know, I met this girl called Charlotte, who was Simon's girlfriend at the time, and you know, me and her got on really, really well. And she said she had this boyfriend who was a comedian, and
you fancied her a bit, didn't you? And you were disappointed that she had a boyfriend, which was me.
Yeah, I kind of hated you. I hated the idea of you, because it's always a nice, attractive thing when girls laugh at you.
Yeah,
it is. I mean, I always say, you know, looks fade, but funny's forever. I say to potential wives.
Tell my wife that. So she arranged a kind of meeting for us, and it coincided with a big party that I was having at my house. And so Charlotte was going to come after work and bring Simon. And
that was the girl.
That was the cow. I was quite nervous, actually, to meet him. And because, you know, it's that thing, a lot had been built up about the two of us. Oh, you guys are really going to get on.
And it was so, like a blind date, wasn't it?
It was like a blind date. And so I remember them. I can actually see them now walking in and me not making an effort to go over until I was ready. And then, there was a time a bit later on when he was outside on my balcony, and I kind of went over, and I remember us kind of skirting around one another, and there was a, like, we did impressions and stuff, didn't we?
Basically, we got on really well, and I took Nick out to a couple of comedy gigs, and he came to see me, and I got him ready for his helped him get ready for his first comedy gig, and which was a sort of open mic night at a club called the Cosmic Comedy Club in Fulham in London, which he was great at. I think I still have it on VHS somewhere. That is going on YouTube. And then we hung out a lot.
Put it up with a book.
Yeah. We hung out. I realized we'd hung out almost every day for like a month at one point. And I thought, I've only just met this guy, and I'm absolutely relishing his company. And you know, and that's how it happened. And eventually I broke up with Charlotte, and Nick and I got Nick, thank God. And our friendship endured.
You know, the story I've read is that Simon, you won him over when you did some Star Wars sound that Nick recognized.
No, that was a moment when we realized that we had a big shared sensibility. I made a noise. We're in a restaurant, and we always used to go there after Nick finished his shift. All the waiters at Chiquito's would go and have an after hours drink and food at this place. And we were all sat around this table eating butter chicken. And I think I probably moved a salt cellar across the table or something, like a little droid. And I made a noise of one of the lesser known robots in Star Wars that Nick immediately recognized. And like no one else at the table knew what the noise was apart from Nick. And we looked at each other and it was like, you know stuff. And it was a very small but hugely significant moment.
All right, you got to give us the noise if you still remember.
Oh, it was... It's that one when they're walking through the Death Star and they've got Chewbacca as a fake captive, and this little mouse droid. It's a moment of comedy that actually really worked. George Lucas isn't really renowned for his funnies, but I remember as a kid thinking that was enormously funny. In the midst of this hugely tense sequence, Chewbacca sort of like roars off a tiny little droid, and it's a tension punctuating moment.
And that was your Chewbacca, Nick, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
No, that was Chewbacca.
He's there. Good, good, good. That's
he's
wonderful.
Here with us. He's in our posse these days.
Nick Frost and Simon Pegg star in the new film The World's End. They'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from CVS Pharmacy, where Forever Stamps are sold at the checkout counter 7 days a week. CVS Pharmacy sells Forever Stamps. From Novo Nordisk, committed to diabetes care and changing lives for more than 90 years. NovoNordisk-US.com. And from Wix.com, enabling over 30 million local businesses to create customized websites with the Wix website builder at Wix.com. This is NPR.
Coming up, John Powers introduces us to the character Jack Irish, a hard-boiled Australian detective. Ken Tucker reviews Blurred Lines, the album by Robin Thicke, whose title track has been one of this summer's biggest hits. And Simon Pegg and Nick Frost tell us about making their 2004 comedy Shaun of the Dead. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, in for Terry Gross. We're speaking with Simon Pegg and Nick Frost. They starred in the film Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz, both directed by Edgar Wright. They're all back for a third time in the new movie The World's End, about a bunch of old friends who reunite to finish a pub crawl from their youth. Pegg and Frost have been friends since Pegg, who'd studied drama and done stand-up, met Frost and just had to get him into show business. After you met, I know that you, Simon, you brought Nick Frost into the TV series you were doing called Spaced, which has a real cult following. You want to just quickly describe what your characters were?
Basically, Nick had a character called Mike, Mike Watt, who was a reservist, what we call the Territorial Army in the UK, sort of weapons nut, slightly unhinged, but completely harmless, lovely kind of character, which he used to do for myself and Charlotte, you know, just as a bit in the pub or whatever. And I was really interested in, I felt like Nick was the funniest person I'd ever met, and I was a comic. All my friends were comedians, and no one was funnier than this guy who wasn't a comic. And so I asked Nick if he wouldn't mind if I appropriated that character for the sitcom for Jessica and Hines and I, who wrote Spaced, if we could have Mike and insert him into the story, and you know, and would you play it? And Nick was sort of for. You know, because he just thought might as well. He said yes. And so we took it to the network with Nick already attached and sort of said, okay, we've got this sitcom. This is what we'd like to do. We have this actor who we'd like to play these parts.
This waiter.
I mean, actor. and they went along with it. I think partly because there was another Nick Frost who was in the union, our sort of SAG, which is called Equity. And they just assumed it was him. And by sheer ballsiness, I guess, Nick joined the cast of this sitcom and his life took a different turn. So it was amazing, really, to look back. I mean, Edgar even said to me, are you sure this is a good idea? This guy's never acted before. And you initially weren't a huge fan of it, were you? I mean, of acting.
No. Well, you know, I wasn't... I'd never done it before, you know. I'd never acted before. So it was... You know, it was like My Fair Lady, but with a big fat man. My Fat Lady. We'd go riding on a bike and I'd sit on his crossbar.
The first time he ever finished a scene, I said, by George, I think he's got it.
Yeah. I'd like a white parasol that I'd flick out.
But he soon became like, you know, I mean, Edgar, as soon as he started working, Edgar just fell in love with him and was like... You know, thrilled, and so when Shaun of the Dead became a possibility, when we had the chance to make our own film, and Nick and I had this pre-existing relationship which seemed to work very well on screen, the idea for the film seemed the obvious thing to shape it around myself and Nick as the main characters, and that's how Shaun happened. And you know, obviously that film, which we didn't know would get a release in the UK, let alone in the US, changed everything.
Right. Well, why don't we move to that, and let's hear a clip from Shaun of the Dead. This was in 2004. And Simon, you play a guy who's sort of adrift in London, works in an appliance store. His girlfriend wants something more, breaks up with him at the beginning of the film. And Nick, you're his buddy Ed, who's kind of crude, fun-loving guy. And then there's a zombie attack where
a classic story, though.
Yeah, it's a tale as old as time.
Yes. And of course, you hear on the telly that if you hit the destroy the zombies' brains, that will kill them. And this is a clip where the outbreak has started. Also, if a zombie bites you, you're going to turn into one, so you don't want to be bitten. And Simon, your character, Sean, is in your flat. The two of you are in your apartment, and you're going to call your girlfriend Liz, who's just broken up with you, but instead you've accidentally dialed your mom, who lives with her husband, Philip. Let's listen.
Liz!
Sean!
Mom, hi. I was going to call you. Are you okay?
Yes.
Yeah. What, are you sure?
Some men tried to get into the house.
Well, are they still there?
I'm not sure. We've shut the curtains.
Well, did you try the police?
Well, I thought about it.
Well, are you okay? Did they hurt you?
No, I'm fine. I'm fine.
Mum?
Well, they were a bit bitey.
Mum, have you been bitten?
No, but Philip has.
Oh, okay. Has she been bitten?
No, Philip has.
Oh, okay. Listen, Mum, what sort of state is he in?
Oh, he's fine. Bit under the weather.
I see. What's the deal? We may have to kill my stepdad. Listen, Mum, sit tight, okay? You're not safe there. We're coming over.
I don't want to cause a fuss.
We're coming to get you, Barbara.
And that is our guests, Dick Frost and Simon Pegg, in the Edgar Wright film Shaun of the Dead. And we have to say that was Penelope Wilton there, the mom, who found the men a bit bitey.
Yes.
This is so much fun because you're just playing on, I think it was David Edelstein wrote afterward that the English have this inexhaustible wellspring of comedy, bestial urges and excellent manners. You know, we hear her. You know, don't mind me, but the world is coming to an end. It's just such great fun.
And also, we had this idea that even amidst the apocalypse, the minutiae of day-to-day life just doesn't change. You know, that's kind of what Shaun of the Dead is about. He's trying to save his relationship amid a zombie apocalypse, despite the fact that it's happening. And he still doesn't get on with his girlfriend's friends, and his relationship with his stepdad is still problematic, even though in some respects, the zombie apocalypse sort of catalyzes a resolution there, albeit a tragic one. But that was also something very interesting to us, that we wanted to make the kind of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead of the zombie world, and have this strange little the side story happening in the Romero universe. This, you know, the great zombie films that George Romero created, and he created that whole mythology as well. The whole modern zombie was basically George's doing. Mm-hmm. You know, he combined old sort of voodoo stories and this sort of slight cannibal fad there was in the late 60s, and he created this, you know, cannibalistic modern zombie, which is all his idea. And I think shows like The Walking Dead and Shaun of the Dead and anything really post George owes him a huge debt of gratitude, because I mean, Shaun and The Walking Dead are essentially just George's idea taken on in a different direction. You know,
there is a lot of action here. I mean, in this film, you're whacking zombies all the time. You kill Bill Nye a couple of times, this continues in the other movies and in the new one. There's a lot of action sequences. Does it get harder to do as you get older?
It's funny, actually. I think the amount of action in each film has increased as we've got older.
I think you just have to, you know, it's also what the role needs. You know exactly what you need to do physically and the shape you need to be in to be able to do these. You know, one of these fights in World's End took 8 days to shoot, you know, and you're fighting for 11 or 12 hours a day for 8 days, you know. So it's, I never made a movie, like a movie in my, an action movie in my 20s, so I have nothing to compare it to be honest. But it just, you know, it's always a nice thing when you go home and you're bruised and you've been punching stuntmen all day, and it's a good pain. It's that kind of pain where you just feel like you've perhaps spent the day digging a big hole or knocking a wall down.
Well, we have to talk about Hot Fuzz. It's the other film in the trilogy that you both did with Edgar Wright. This was in 2007. Simon, you want to just talk a little bit about the idea here? A brilliant London cop exiled to a quiet English village.
Yeah, Hot Fuzz was Edgar's idea in the inception. He kind of liked the prospect of doing an action film set in the UK with British police officers, because they're not particularly cinematically cool. You know, they sort of wear sweaters and carry sticks. And in cinematic terms, they're not particularly romantic. And we'd had this idea about a very, very accomplished London police officer who is reassigned to a small hamlet in rural England because he's so good. He's kind of messing the figures up in London. And we wanted this clash of parochial British policing and sort of Michael Bay style action, and we wanted the film to start off very much as a sort of Miss Marple kind of Agatha Christie bucolic kind of very 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 English set crime thriller, and it become this extraordinary high octane action flick.
Let's hear a clip from Hot Fuzz. I mean, this is where the two of you, you know, Simon, you're this London cop who's in this quiet village, and Nick, you're playing his partner, Danny Butterman, who's the son of the inspector, and you're sitting in the patrol car, and Nick's character, Danny, is munching on an ice cream. The scene begins when he asks his partner if he wants something from the snack shop. Let's listen.
Want anything from the shop?
You've just been to the shop.
Thinking of a different shop.
Constable Butterman, this is not the time for personal errands.
Well, there's nothing going on, is there?
There is always something going on. You have to look closer. All right. What about this guy?
Mr. Treacher?
Yeah. Why has he got that big coat on? Can't be cold. Why the extra layer? Maybe he's trying to hide something.
Mr. Treacher?
Okay, what about this guy? Ask yourself, why has he got his hat pulled down like that?
He's ugly.
Or he doesn't want you to see his face.
Because he's ugly.
Okay, what's his story?
Oh, it's Lurch.
Go on.
It's a trolley boy at the local supermarket.
Good.
Real name Michael Armstrong.
Uh-huh.
Dad says he's got a child's mind.
Okay.
Lives up Summer Street with his mum and his sister.
And are they as big as he is?
Who?
The mum and the sister.
Same person.
And that's our guest Simon Pegg and Nick Frost in the 2007 film Hot Fuzz. I love that line, same person.
Dad says he's got a child's mind.
That really makes me and Simon laugh.
I think it's the kind of, it's the hee-haw joke. I mean, that's the the classic thing when you get to the countryside, everyone's related. Maybe a little bit more than they should be.
Right.
But we couldn't resist it.
You know, people describe Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz, and the new one, The World's End, as a trilogy because it's the two of you and your director, Edgar Wright. Did you conceive of it as a trilogy, and is there more coming?
No, we didn't. Absolutely not. I think it would be arrogant and untruthful to say that we ever did. Arrogant, I think, at the time, because it would assume that we were going to make three films. And, you know, at the time of Shaun of the Dead, we just wanted to get that film made. We didn't know if we'd ever get to make another film again. So it was just about that. When we made Hot Fuzz, and we realized that we could make a sort of thematic sequel to Shaun of the Dead, not a direct one, but one that at least kind of displayed similar approaches, addressed similar themes. We were dealing with protracted adolescence again. We were looking at the notion of loss of identity, the struggle of the individual against the collective. There's a deeper connection to the films that I think is really easy to trace when you watch them together. And if you watch them apart, it really doesn't matter. We will make more films together, I have no doubt, but they won't necessarily have to abide by that criteria. They could be something completely different to what we've done before, which would be a nice, change.
Well, Simon Pegg, Nick Frost, it's been fun. We'll look forward to seeing what you come up with next. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Not at all.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having us.
Simon Pegg and Nick Frost star in the new film, The World's End. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews Robin Thicke's new album, Blurred Lines. This is Fresh Air. Robin Thicke is a singer whose single, Blurred Lines, seems to be the pop hit of the summer. And yes, he is the son of TV sitcom star Alan Thicke. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of Robin Thicke's new album, also called Blurred Lines, and some thoughts on a controversy surrounding the single.
Everybody get up.
Robin Thicke exudes a kind of oily charm that is, with the right material, by no means off-putting. A prime example is the song that led off this review. Blurred Lines gives you the complete Robin Thicke experience. The song is a come-on, because basically all Thicke does in his music is try to put the make on women. What prevents him from being too creepy is that he's also genial, even gentlemanly and debonair, when the object of his lust shoots him down. Sometimes his songs sound like parodies of hip-hop, of the sort Andy Samberg does with his pals in The Lonely Island, as on this thick song, For the Rest of My Life. Finally convince you to come over and just say hi. I'll say wherever my lady and kiss you for the very first time. After months, holidays, holding hands in the park. Normally I just play basketball or something in the park. And I messed up like boys tend to do. It'd be a year till I got back with you. Thank God that you called me back, baby. 'Cause I'd never be the man that I am today. For the rest of my life, you know. Listen and Look Past is Roué Image, and Robin Thicke is revealed as an earnest nostalgist. He persistently makes music that harks back to the Quiet Storm soul and disco of the 70s and 80s. He's a smirky but sincere curator of the old sounds he loves, straining to approximate the croons of vocalists such as Peebo Bryson, Frankie Beverly, and Felipe Wynn. Blurred Lines album is, overall, a fetching pop collection, a dreamy makeout record. But it threatens to be overshadowed by Blurred Lines the single, which is a phenomenon that just keeps on inspiring cultural contradictions. The video for the song shows Thicke, producer Pharrell Williams, and the rapper T.I. surrounded by skimpily dressed young women who flit around the men and buzz away. Some people were offended by this. Now there's a question about the song's provenance. Specifically, think of the percolating rhythm of Marvin Gaye's 1977 song, Got to Give It Up. Now listen to a bit more of Blurred Lines. Last week, it was announced that Thicke's legal team is doing some preemptive work. They're suing Marvin Gaye's estate to prevent any potential lawsuit over the similarities between Blurred Lines and Got to Give It Up. For good measure, Thicke's team included the 1974 funkadelic song Sexy Ways in the suit just in case, even as author George Clinton has already said he has nothing against Thicke's song. Now, when it comes to filching melodies and hooks, I give pop music a lot of slack. Whenever someone wants to yell sonic plagiarism, I get this image in my mind of Jimmy Page holding a stack of old blues guitar records and chuckling with a wily rasp. One thing pop music is tidy about is recycling. Robin Thicke is not only not going to cut into the sales of Marvin Gaye or funkadelic music. If anything, these songs are now going to be listened to by a generation that may not have heard the songs previously. As for Robin Thicke, well, he's a hard worker. He's been churning out songs for other acts, as well as himself, since the late 90s. And he's done it by blurring stylistic lines with a wink and a smile that just gets more sly, more knowing, with every release. Come on, let's go.
Ken Tucker reviewed Robin Thicke's album Blurred Lines. Coming up, John Powers introduces us to the hard-boiled Australian character Jack Irish. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. The crime novelist Peter Temple is one of Australia's most popular and honored writers. The book that first made his name in the mid-90s featured an unconventional lawyer named Jack Irish, who became so enduringly popular that the Australian Broadcasting Company recently started making TV films of the Jack Irish series, with Guy Pearce in the lead. The first two are now available in the U.S. from Acorn Media, where you can stream them on Acorn TV or get them on DVD beginning October 1st. Our critic at large, John Powers, is a great fan of Temple's, and he says these films capture something distinctive about the Australian psyche.
When Raymond Chandler first set Philip Marlowe walking down the mean streets of L.A., he couldn't have imagined that eventually every city, from ancient Athens to 21st century Bangkok, would have its own detective series. Of course, they're not all equally good. The best ones have heroes that capture their hometown's special tang. You know, Ian Rankin's brooding, boozing Edinburgh cop John Rebus, or Sarah Paretsky's tough, sarcastic V.I. Warshawski from big-shouldered Chicago. The great Melbourne detective is Jack Irish, the hero of four novels by Peter Temple. Irish is a lawyer-turned-scruffy fix-it man whose virtues, shrewdness, dark humor, unpretentious decency, and loyalty to those who deserve it, embodies Melbourne's, if not Australia's, fantasy of itself. The first two Irish novels, Bad Debts and Black Tide, have recently been turned into TV movies available from Acorn Media. Not only are they very enjoyable, they star the wonderful actor Guy Pearce, they take us inside a distinctively Aussie version of heroism and corruption. The first one to watch is Bad Debts, for when we meet Irish, he's still a successful attorney, sleek and a tad self-satisfied. Then his adored wife Isabel is murdered by a disgruntled client. The next time we see him, years have passed, years of hard drinking, and Irish is now a study in dishevelment. He spends his time working for a gambler and drinking Melbourne bitter at the Prince of Prussia pub, along with geriatric fans obsessed with the Fitzroy Football Club. Then one of Irish's ex-clients is murdered, a client he defended badly during his drunkard days. Seeking redemption, he begins looking into it, an investigation that brings him in contact with a local reporter, Linda Hillier, played by Marta Dusseldorp, who's destined to be his love interest. Irish soon grasps he's working on one of those cases that start with small fry, but keep leading to bigger and bigger sharks. Dodgy cops, greedy developers, crooked politicos. Not that he doesn't have time to sleep with Linda. Here, the two engage in a bit of post-coital pillow talk in his bed.
So, did you live here with your wife?
Yeah.
Do all the girls ask that?
Yeah, every single one of them. No, you're the first. Well, you're the only, actually.
So you were a faithful husband. I had you picked as a wild boy.
Domesticated as a neutered cat, I'm afraid. I always thought Isabel was kind of out of my league. You know, like she was a mirage or something.
Yeah, mine was more coma than mirage. I married a gastroenterologist. And our hobbies included waking to alarms and supermarket shopping and Sunday lunches with the in-laws.
And how did that finish up?
In the arms of a rock singer. Disgracefully.
The Irish films make a good introduction to the work of Peter Temple, who's just a terrific writer. Sharp, funny, and ambitious. Although he could have continued to crank out the Jack Irish series, he moved on to novels that use crime plots in search of bigger game, the way Kate Atkinson and James Ellroy have. In fact, Temple's finest books, Truth and The Broken Shore, won him Australia's two biggest literary prizes. I highly recommend them both. Where too many crime novels mistake testosterone for manliness, Temple's work is consciously about masculinity, in particular what he thinks are dangerous Australian notions of being a man. After all, maleness is a great vexed theme in this famously hard country, colonized by famously hard men. This hardness is admired to this day, the way cowboys used to be admired in America. There's a reason why, when Hollywood has needed an actor to play someone really, really virile, it has so often cast Aussies like Russell Crowe, Hugh Jackman, Chris Hemsworth, Eric Bana, and the late Heath Ledger. Fearful of appearing soft, Temple's heroes must deal with an oppressive legacy of ultra-manly fathers and struggle with the deep ideology of male friendship that requires unquestioning loyalty to one's mates, even when those mates are doing bad things. In Irish's case, he's the educated son of a brawling football star and remains faithful to honorable manly traditions like being able to make things. He studies woodworking with an old craftsman, while pointedly not being an old-school macho. Irish's blend of old and new masculinity is perfectly conveyed by Pierce, who's not merely the best reason to watch these movies, but one of the best reasons to watch anything. When younger, he was a bit tightly wound, and his prettiness could make him seem slightly sinister. But the years have made him more weathered and relaxed, and he slips into Irish's skin with a movie star's confident ease. What we want most from a detective is that he or she be good company, and Pierce's Jack Irish is that. You wish you could meet him at the Prince of Prussia for a pint.
John Powers is film and TV critic for Vogue and Vogue.com. You can follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. Our blog is on Tumblr at nprfreshair.tumblr.com. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. John Sheehan directed today's show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Walmart, where Forever Stamps are sold at the register 7 days a week. Walmart sells Forever Stamps. From Angie's List, providing reviews of local roofers, painters, landscapers, and plumbers to keep the consumer informed. More at angieslist.com. And from Chevrolet, maker of the Volt, an electric car also powered by gas to help drivers go the distance and then some. Details at ChevyVolt.com. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, we remember Elmore Leonard, the crime novelist and screenwriter behind Get Shorty, Out of Sight, and Fire in the Hole, which was adapted into the FX series Justified. Leonard died Tuesday at 86. We'll also listen back to an interview with jazz pianist Marion McPartland. She died Tuesday at 95. Join us.